in this section on the communion of saints, the whole rest of it is going to be looking at one saint. You could do it for every saint that you could, but I want to just focus on one as archetypical, Mary, the mother of Jesus and the mother of the church. In doing so, I'm gathering a whole lot of material from the earlier part of the catechism, which I'd left out then. So I'm bringing it all together in this one place. And I want to start with a wonderful statement, which, John, I have to tell you, will fit. You'll love this, because it fits with what you were saying a bit. This is St. Therese of Lisieux. So we're talking about a pretty highly intelligent, very focused saint here. And she says this: "How I would have loved to be a priest, so to preach about the Blessed Virgin. One sermon would be sufficient to say everything. Everything I think about the subject. For a sermon on the Blessed Virgin to please me and to do me any good," says this lovely saint, "I must see her real life, not her imagined life. I'm sure that her real life was very simple. They show her to us as unapproachable, but they should present her as imitable, bringing out her virtues, saying that she lived by faith just like ourselves. Give proofs of this from the Gospel, where we read, 'And they didn't understand the words which he spoke to them.' And that other, no less mysterious statement, 'His father and mother marvelled at what was said about him.' This admiration supposes a certain surprise. We know very well that the Blessed Virgin is Queen of heaven and earth, but she's more mother than queen. And we shouldn't say, on account of her prerogatives, that she surpasses all the saints in glory, just as the sun at his rising makes the stars disappear from sight. Brackets, she's just repeating the stuff that was said at the beginning of this century, last century, 100 years ago, in homilies about Mary. And they went right on till the Vatican Council, basically. It was all superlatives about this wonderful Mary, the Mother of God. And she heard all these homilies too, and they did no good to her. They may not do any good to you." How strange that would be, says Therese. A mother who makes her children's glory vanish? I myself think just the opposite, good honour. I believe that she will increase the splendour of the elect very much. That's a short part of a longer statement she makes, but I wanted to start there. So let's cool it all down a bit, and let's talk about a wonderful human being who, marvellous as she is as a person, if you're marvellous as a person, you are by necessity heroic, not privileged. There's a certain, if your mum and dad were a saint and all your brothers and sisters were saints, you probably had a reasonable childhood and a home, and you were given advantages that others weren't, you know, who were in a mucked up situation. Okay, so a lot of it is providence, but we've got to make the best of whatever situations we're in. And if we do make the best of it, if you become a saint in that situation yourself, then I will bet there's been a lot of heroic decisions made along the line by you. Choices that you've chosen, things you haven't done, things you could have done and didn't, and all that. It must be the same with Mary. And Therese of Lisieux is right on the ball there of a wonderful human being. So let's have a look more now at some of that. Let's start with Mary's Immaculate Conception. This was defined prior to the First Vatican Council, when the infallibility was itself defined. So this was led to it, I suppose. But in 1854, on December the 8th, in fact, that's the foundation day of our religious order, the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart. That's when our order was founded. So we've got a very close connection with the definition of this Immaculate Conception of Mary. What do we mean by that? To grasp what's intended by this assertion, we need to explore the notion of original sin, a topic which we'll return to. We've already done it, and we're going to return to it later. Mary, along with all of us, including Jesus, was born into a world grievously affected by the sins of others, including the sins of our origins, which is what we mean by original sin, the sin of our origins. Sin, or she, Mary, was not unaffected by the hereditary and environmental sludge of sin. We're all in it. You see what I'm trying to say? We're not talking about personal sin here. We're talking about you. I have a little image for it when I use it. Baptism sometimes like a little fish spawned into a river. Perfect little creature. Just absolutely perfect. But the river's polluted. It's got beautiful things in it, but it's partly polluted. So the fish is... the little one may be harmed because it's trying to get oxygen purely from an unpure river. And it might get some stuff in from the factory upstream. So you are affected by your grandparents, your parents particularly, your school kids. When you went to school the first day and they picked on you for about 10 years in the nice little Catholic school that you went to. And they kept picking on you because you were too thin, too fat, too short, too tall, because you're always too something. And they, you know, and it kind of hurts you and you become very shy and very whatever. So that's original sin. It's not your own sins. It's the sin of your origins, sin of the world into which we're conceived. Well, Jesus was conceived into that world and so was Mary. So there's no difference there. The point being made is that like her son and unlike us, this is what we say about her, she never allowed it to affect her decisions. Heroically, from the very first moment of her existence, from her conception, she was never contaminated by sin. She always said yes to grace. That's what we're saying in our faith. Even when she stood watching her innocent son being crucified before her eyes, her response was one of pure love. Now, the next point is my best understanding of what we're saying, and that's all I can offer it as. There have been saints whose lives were pure from their most tender years. Therese of Lisieux may be one of them, you know, very amazing young girl and a young woman. If you read about her first communion, it's just amazing. And thanks to her big sisters who helped her, she was, yeah. So, but you think, there are other people, you may be one of them, who have been really beautiful, saintly people from very, very young. Okay, how does one speak then of Jesus' mother in any other way than the language of the heart? The language of love poetry. It's not market research, it's not factual information because we know everything that Mary ever did and we were there with cameras watching, and as a little two-year-old she never screamed or she never did anything wrong, or three-year-old, or she never stamped her feet, and you know what I mean? We're not saying any of that. Oh, I don't think we are, because we don't know any of that. All we know is that those people who knew her as a woman, okay, she probably had Jesus... We're not sure, but it's highly likely she would have been 14 years old, because that was the custom. As soon as a girl was able to have a child, her parents organised her to be handed over to a faithful man for, you know, exchange of whatever happened. And he would be typically 25, and he would have studied the Torah, and he would have a trade. In Joseph's case, it was carpentry. We know that from the Gospels. We don't know much about it. So we're talking about a 14-year-old girl, basically, who conceives and has a little baby when she's maybe just 15, something like that. That's a guess, but that's what you would have to expect. We're not told that, but that's highly likely. So you've got this love, and from then on, when people knew her, and maybe what her mum and dad told them about her when she was tiny, I don't know, all of that means we're dealing with the most beautiful woman that everyone... There was a lot of other beautiful women around at that time, saintly, beautiful people, but Mary really stood out. What's the, no problem with that. I haven't got a problem with that, have you? Somebody always like this, so exceptionally lovely. And everything they... So how do you talk about someone who was a saint, the purest of saints, the most loving saint, the most tender one, the one who suffered probably enormously, the one who was so close to Jesus, all of those things? I think what you do is you write poetry, you put on a play, you do some liturgical dancing, you do an icon, you paint a picture. You're into heart language, and when you get heart language, you don't tear it apart and say, oh yeah, If you said, one of you blokes, I'm sure you said it to your on your courting days when you were the truth was a bit loose. No, you probably said, you know, you're the most beautiful girl I've ever seen, and you actually meant it. But if someone had have come along and said, all right, well, okay, most beautiful, let's look at this. What do you mean? And you go through all the... You'd say, oh, leave me alone. I mean, I just love this woman, for God's sake. You're saying something true that's coming from your heart, but you couldn't actually prove it, do you know what I mean? Detail it and lock it in and scientifically establish it. It's not that kind of language. All our language about Mary is the language of the heart. It's poetic. But it's not silly. It's saying something truthful. What are we saying then? We're saying that from the first moment of her conception, John the Baptist, we say, was pure from the time when he jumped in his mother's womb. Well, that's very naive. And remember that time when we say, well, Mary has to be a bit purer than that. So, you know, how do you go back from a kid kicking you in the womb? You go back to conception, and it's not... Well, I haven't got any problems with it. If you have, I can't help you. I just think it's a simple love statement about the most beautiful woman that her contemporaries had ever seen. And if that does, that does me anyhow. The Catechism, this is a language problem now, speaks of her being, you brought it up in your question, predestined by God to be the mother of Jesus. I hope you can see the philosophical problem in that statement. I can, I hope you can, because I've done it often with you. It's essential to exclude the notion of time from any concept in regard to God. Time and space are the two hardwired things in our brain that we cannot think and imagine, because you can only think with images. We can't think without them until we cancel them out. So we're always thinking in time. We're thinking that God foresees and God remembers. The Bible's full of it. God doesn't foresee and God doesn't remember. God sees, God knows. There's no time in God. Once you get that philosophically clear, then you have to just keep realizing that when you get the images, you just put a line through them. They're wrong. But you're still trying to say something truthful with wrong images. So predestined doesn't mean before in time. God's got a plan, and he's organizing everything, and it's all coming on track. And he's thinking, my God. I'm not going to tell sorry, how does that? By this time next week, everything will kick in. So God's up there listening to the Alleluias and all that for another week before finally the thing... That's thinking like human beings. Stop it. Don't do it. Don't hurt yourself. Predestined, I'll say what it does mean, doesn't imply temporal priority, but priority at the level of reality. Prodestined might be another way. It means God's will is prior to ours, not in time, but in, because God is the one who holds us in being. God is the one gracing us. We can't do anything without God. God is the initiator, not the responder. So if you're going to look at anything that happens in our life, we best look at what God is doing before we look at anything else. You get me? Because it's prior. It's initiating. But God's only present. We're only present too, by the way. Sorry to tell you that, but it's true. This is as good as it gets. Why you came here and spent Tuesday morning sitting here, you could have been doing something else, but this is as good as it gets, because this is your present moment. And the present is all you've got. Your past has brought you to this present moment, and this present moment will itself expand into the next present moment, which is already happening, and we can't stop it. So, but the present is all we've got, and we've got to live in the present moment as beautifully and as lovingly as we can. And in that this present moment, you know, God is initiating, God is gracing, God is willing, God is inspiring, God is all of those things. So predestined only means that. The initiative and the grace comes from God. What we do and what we happen to us is always in response to grace. So God predestining Mary to be the mother of Jesus, what is it saying? I don't know, is the simple answer, but I know you don't either. Do you know what I mean? It's not something we can know, but I think what we're saying is, why is Jesus the Messiah? Maybe we should look at it another way. Maybe we should say, Jesus is who he is because Mary is who she was. Maybe, I don't know, maybe if in China in 214 BC there was a young woman who was totally open to grace, favoured one, specially favoured, specially graced, but specially graced and welcomed the grace, because we're all specially graced, welcomed this special grace, her son may well have been the Son of God, may well have been the Messiah. I mean, we can only talk about what we know, not what could have been. Do you get me? Everything's possible. The fact is that it's Jesus we're talking about, and he was Mary's child. So if Jesus was as beautiful as he was, that's got a lot to do with Mary being as beautiful as she was and opening herself totally to grace. And that's got a lot to do with what Mary chose to be, which was always in response to grace. That's how I see it. I can't put it better than that. Could God have graced someone in India in 4000 BC? Could God have graced other people? I can't think why not. But maybe nobody responded quite the way Mary did to make possible the incarnation. Yeah, okay, we'll have to come back on this when you get time to ask questions, I guess. But I'll just move on and leave you with that in your mind. Or should I stop now and get some clarification from you? Happy if I go on? Okay. We talk about Mary being a virgin. Central dogma. Again, I'm going to try and make as little and as much sense of it as I can. The prologues to the Gospel of Matthew and Luke portray Mary as a virgin. And in fidelity to Scripture, the Church has continued to speak of her as the Virgin Mary. By the way, I have a CD entirely on this topic, which is on my list in the computer, whatever you call that, the website, where I've gone into this so carefully over, I think it must have been an hour and a half. So I'm unable to do it as carefully and methodically with you now in this 5-10 minutes. But if you do want to explore it, I suppose I'm recommending that CD that you can obtain from me should you wish to explore it really carefully. I'll be careful now, but I'll be a bit quick. So, in view of the highly symbolic nature of the prologues, this is quite important, it seems to me best to go to the deepest meaning of virgin and for the rest to remain in silence as we contemplate the wonder of what God has done in Mary and the wonder of her complete and loving response. Nowhere in the scriptures is Mary called a virgin except in the first two chapters of Luke, and you know that story, and the first two chapters of Matthew. I'm not arguing from silence, anything. But it is interesting that nowhere in Paul's letters, nowhere in the Matthew's Gospel, Mark's Gospel, nowhere in John's Gospel, nowhere in the Gospel proper, which begins with the baptism of Jesus, is this ever referred to. So just know the fact. Once you know that and you realise the nature of the prologues, they're not biographical material, they're large theological statements like an overture to prepare us for what Luke and Matthew to their different communities want to say about Jesus. Okay, so they're Jesus-centred, as the whole Gospels are. So that makes us a bit careful about how we read the prologues. You take it for granted, for example, that it's a fact that when Jesus was 12 years old, he went to the temple and was lost in the temple. You probably take that as a fact. I don't. I just take it as a reflection back, because that's not the aim of the Gospel, to tell us a fact about Jesus. Otherwise, all you've got is about 3 or 4 facts about Jesus up till he's 30. That's all you've got. No, the interest in that is talking about Jesus from the first moment of his manhood, which is, the bar mitzvah now, but, the first moment when he becomes an adult Jew, he is in the temple doing God's will. That's what the author wants us to say. That's what he's actually communicating. Right from the beginning. Now, it may have been, in fact, that when Jesus, because every child was asked to go to do this, it could have been that when Jesus was 12, he had whooping cough and couldn't get there. Do you know? So the author isn't telling us, I was there and this happened. He's saying the essence of who Jesus is to be one who is about his Father's business from the beginning when the Torah asked it of him. That's what you're being told by the scene. I hope I haven't disturbed you too much there. It's just factual information is not what they're basically about. They're talking about reality at a very profound level of art, and they're full of, well, read my commentaries on them if you want any more. I can't do any better than that. So, because they're highly symbolic documents, I'm suggesting let's go to what a virgin is at the deepest, deepest level. Hold that, because that's our faith. And maybe you hold a lot more, and maybe there's a little bit of uncertainty about the others, and maybe there are levels of virginity that we just aren't sure about, and I can live with it, you might be able to live with it too, because there's a lot of things we just don't know. Luke's account of Mary's conceiving Jesus, beautiful passage. It's about prayer. You didn't have to be there. No one was there, by the way. It was an experience of Mary at 14 years old in her complete communion with God. And it's expressed in a way by Luke in that Annunciation scene, which is a typical scene of prayer. He's inviting everybody into that. This is what we do when we pray. We're all part of this. So it's an artistic form. Luke's account appropriately speaks of her intimate communion with God. In Luke's delicate narrative, it's God himself who approaches Mary, offering her love. Now, in the scene, it's an angel, isn't it? The angel Gabriel came to Mary. That's perfectly biblical, because God is transcendent, for heaven's sake. And all through the Bible, it's the angel of the Lord that comes. It's God as God communicates with us, not the transcendent God who didn't walk in the door and ring the bell and, you know, don't be... So what the story is actually telling us is basically it's God. It's God under a certain aspect. It's prayer, it's for heaven's sake. So it's God coming to Mary, clearly. And mediated in the drama of the gospel through this figure that you can kind of half imagine. You don't know how to imagine angels either. But it's kind of a mediator coming. All right. He offers her love, and Mary says yes, opening herself to God's embrace. Let it be done to me as you have said. It's God who comes. And it's quite sexual, and appropriately so. You remember, she says, how can I be the mother when I do not know man? Know meaning intimate communion with man. She's betrothed. She's looking forward to her marriage, as the scene is portrayed. But she's not yet married. And she says, well, how can I be a mother? And God says, just listen to it. I will come down upon you. Is that sexual enough? I will cover you with my glory. You know, the covering of the... And I will breathe my breath into you, for heaven's sake. So it's God saying, it's all right, darling, I'll love you. It's okay. I'll love you. I'll be the one loving you. So it'll be possible. Everything's possible to God. In fact, that's what the passage goes on to say. But it's a beautiful, intimate scene of a woman being loved by God. And all you beautiful women, when you fell pregnant, were loved by God. God breathed his love into you too. Do you get me? It's not setting her apart. It's saying what every conception really is at its most profound level. A virgin is one who gives his or her first love to the betrothed. That's what Mary does. She's a virgin in that her first love is for God. That's a little... picture I found somewhere in La Verna. Just a dozen. Hail Mary, full of grace, or as you said quite rightly, John, full of grace means graced fully. So specially loved. The Lord is with you. Yahweh is with you. And then the Holy Spirit will come upon you. The power of the Most High will cover you with its, we keep translating it, shadow. It's not a very good word, shadow. Shadow in English is a negative word. I mean, it can be. Shadow can mean like the shadow side. It's shade. It's the shade. It's the tent in the burning desert sun. This is a lovely protecting shade. And it's the Shekinah. It's the glory cloud. It's the sunset cloud, full of light and love and colour and rainbows and everything. Not a dark shadow. So just be careful how you translate it. Therefore, because the power of the Most High will cover you, the child will be holy, and he will be called the Son of God. It's the embrace of God that made the conceiving of Jesus possible. It was her being drawn so intimately into God's embrace that accounts for the conceiving of Jesus. God, the source of all life, is in a special way Jesus' Father. Obviously, metaphorically, Father. The source of his life is the source of all our lives. So we all say, Abba, Father. I am the handmaid of the Lord, said Mary. And she doesn't do anything. It's perfect. It's a perfect reply. She doesn't say, I'll do what you tell me, because she wasn't told to do anything. She was offered love. So she says, love me, God. Let what you have said be done to me. God is asking only one thing of Mary, to say yes to God's love, which she does with all her heart. God is saying to her, I want to love you, and she replies, love me, and the fruit of that mysterious embrace is Jesus. That's all I want to say about the Virgin Mary. It does lead to questions then about biological issues that you could go into, Joseph and Mary and so on, and they're perhaps interesting, don't interest me a lot, I have to tell you, but they're not central. For example, if Joseph and Mary had ordinary sexual relations and Jesus was their child, it wouldn't have anything at all to do with Jesus being the Son of God. It wouldn't make the slightest difference to our theology. Not the slightest. Do you get me? I mean, it doesn't make any difference. Our understanding of who Jesus is not dependent on a biological factor. That's the fact. Ratzinger himself said that before he was Pope, but he'd still say it, I'm sure. So Jesus being the Son of God doesn't require a bypassing of paternity on Joseph's part, theologically. Is that all right? I mean, that's the fact. That's defensible entirely. Now, I'm not saying... I'm just holding back. I can't think of anything else to do except to say everybody understands the virginity of Mary to be a miracle that bypassed ordinary conception processes, that was something from God to Mary, and that accounts for the whole thing. And if people think like that, all I can do is be reverent to their thoughts. If you ask me what I think, I have to say I don't know. But I know that Mary was a virgin. I know that Mary's first love was given to God. And I know that God's loving her was the key reason, obviously, for the conception of this beautiful boy called Jesus. That's as far as I know. Maybe I should know more, but I've studied it to the best of my ability, and that's as far as I'm able to go, and that's all I'm saying to you. And I hope you can go further. So, in every aspect of Mary's life, she's presented to us as a model, including the Virgin Mary. That's worth thinking about too. Here it is, number 967 of the Catechism. By her complete adherence to the Father's will, to his Son's redemptive work, not her redemptive work, her Son's redemptive work, and to every prompting of the Holy Spirit, the Virgin Mary is the Church's model of faith and charity. They could have said hope too, but you know, she's the model for us. The model. There's plenty of models. Our main models will be the ones closest to us, like your parents or somebody you know that's really holy. But Mary is presented always because of her intimate communion with Jesus. Luke is presenting Mary as the model of all who conceive. You see, there is a danger in presenting Mary as though she's different. Do you get it? Just as we suffered in earlier years, Jesus was different. So different. He was God. I'm not saying he wasn't, but I'm just saying we were so blinded by the sunlight of God's divinity, of Jesus' divinity, that all of us, everyone I've ever met, I have to say, had problems with his humanity. How could he not know if he was God? And Why did he choose Judas when he knew Judas was going to betray him? Do you get me? All these, they're actually silly questions, but not silly blameworthy. Silly because of the way Jesus was presented to us. Instead of starting where we know he was human, therefore he didn't know the future, therefore he cried, therefore he got a shock when things happened, therefore he asked questions because he didn't know the answer. Do you get me? That's what human beings do. He was like us in everything, but he is the incarnation of God. He's the human expression of God. He's the one who reveals God in a human way to us. All of that we've hopefully spent weeks on. But that's the only way to approach the mystery. So we start with Mary. She is surely presented to us as the model of those who conceive. And if she is, that's got to be depthed as well. How beautiful it would be if every man and every woman in their intimate communion were to give their first love to God, so that our loving was fully open to God's grace. Wouldn't you like that? Wouldn't that be a beautiful way to be a husband or a wife? Wouldn't that be a beautiful way to conceive? Is there a better way to conceive? Do you get me? So she's the model of that total openness. Then the fruit conceived of that love would come from our intimacy with God. God would be the predestining, the source of, please God, that's how it is, the children you have, but nurtured in grace. Isn't that what we mean by the sacrament of marriage? Couldn't Mary and Joseph be presented to us as the perfect model, the holy family? Could be, but it would require care in our information at the biological level. I really don't want to say any more. I can't say any more. I'm just left with the mystery of it. Now we move on from that. Mary, these are little statements that you know from the Bible that actually help explore what we know about the womb. Why is she blessed? And this is for us too. Blessed is she who believed that the promise made her by the Lord would be fulfilled. That's an absolutely stunning line put in there by Luke. He's writing it. Who knows what Elizabeth said to Mary, when she might have said, oh, gore blimey, what are you doing here this early? I don't need you. You know, go home and look after your husband. I mean, we just weren't there to know. But as it's presented, we're being presented with Mary, who's first doing God's will, falling pregnant with God, you know, as you all of you do. Her first thought was for the other. It was to give. It was to grace others, to hasten, to be of service to other people. Isn't that good? And here it says, why is she blessed? Because she believes. So ask yourself this. I ask myself, I have to. Do I really believe that the promise made me will be fulfilled? On my ordination day, which was 45 years ago, on the feast of St. Peter and Paul, which has just happened. Okay? I made a promise, yeah, but God made a promise to me. Do I believe that it will be fulfilled? Oh, God, if I've got to answer that, I say sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I wonder. But I mean, I'd be blessed if I really believed it. And you'd be blessed if you're alive. God has promised you eternal life. Do you believe that? Can you hold on to that? Can you trust it? When you were married, when you, whatever decisions you've made in your life that are significant, trusting that the promise God made you would be fulfilled is a wonderful thing. Mary did it, and we're told that she did it, so that we'll learn to do it. Mary treasured all that was said and pondered in her heart. Do I do that? Do you do that? Do we treasure what has been said and do we ponder it in our heart, or do we get caught up in a culture? Oh, it's not a culture really. I heard someone say yesterday, or not yesterday, a few days ago, I thought it was quite smart really, and being smart's always dangerous. The United States is the only country that's gone from barbarism to decadence without passing through civilization. Now, I thought it was fairly smart, but okay, let's hold up the mirror. Australia, you know, Europe's gone through a lot and they've learnt a lot, but Australia, have we gone from this? Do we just get on the coattails of barbarism and hedonism and Big Brother? And I've heard of it, I've never watched it, of course, but How could Big Brother be the most popular thing on TV when it is so poor? So what on earth are we doing? What is the culture? Well, we haven't got civilization. We haven't got culture. We've got it in little pockets, but as a community. So pondering things in our hearts is what we need to do, and not get caught up, I'm not preaching to you, I'm talking to myself, but not get caught up in the trivial second-by-second busyness of a distracting world. We've got to live a reflective life, all of us. She did. She's offered as a model by Luke. Look at it. Do this. Jesus' father and mother were amazed at what was being said by Simeon about Jesus. That was referred to by Teresa of Lisieux. They were amazed at it. And yet, some of you probably thought, some of you might have even been told, and don't blame the person who told you because they were probably told it too, that, you know, Mary from the beginning knew all about everything. She knew what Jesus was and knew he was going to get crucified. And, you know, it's balmy. She's just amazed at what Simeon's telling her. And Simeon blessed them and said, Mary, a sword will pierce your soul too. Hands up any mother here who hasn't had a sword piercing her soul. No, don't put your hand up, but do you know what I'm... I mean, life's beautiful, but it's, yeah. There's just a couple of little pictures I thought I'd show you. That's Mary, mother of Jesus. I did it with you earlier, but the Council of Ephesus called her Theotokos, which means bearer of God. So we call her the mother of God, and what we only mean, this is the trouble with words, what we only mean, it means nothing more than the mother of Jesus. The mother of God is a statement about Jesus, not about Mary. So, and when we say Jesus is God, that too needs careful. Jesus is not God, the transcendent God who created heaven and earth. Jesus is the incarnation of God, the human expression of God, the one who reveals God in a human way by being human, but perfectly revealing God. So everything needs a lot of nuancing, you know, care. So all we're really saying is Mary is the mother of Jesus and Jesus is the incarnation of God. All that big sentence is the Theotokos. But it's not saying Mary, like the pagans had, you know, the great goddesses who were the mother of the gods, and it's dangerous if we go down that track. It's heresy. That's Mary, the mother of God. Looks pretty ordinary to me. Pretty good. Did she have enough milk to feed the child? I don't know. I wasn't there. She might have had difficulty. She might have got, what's that, mastitis, is it? I mean, they're just human beings, for heaven's sake, struggling in life and doing their best. That's Our Lady of the Sacred Heart picture, just the same. People love the Madonna thing just because everybody melts in front of a little child. On Sunday night mass, we had a little two-week-old child came in. And so, I mean, don't you get gooey like I do? I mean, everybody does. You just see, well, why not look at all this? But keep it human, keep it lovely, keep it beautiful, keep it heroic, you know. They're both heroic people, the two you're seeing there. When Jesus was 12 years old, we're told, I'm just running through the little bits that we know, and this is just all in the prologue. When Jesus was 12 years old, his parents went up to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. And you know about him going missing, etc. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. His parents saw him. Don't miss that. They were astonished, and his mother said to him, Child, why have you treated us like this? She didn't know. She was kind of amazed. Your father and I... Simple enough, isn't it? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you. And the Catechism beautifully speaks, about Mary's pilgrimage of faith. So any idea you've got that Mary, or Jesus for that matter, had a blueprint of the whole life in front of them, and that Mary, that Jesus as a little boy used to make things out of clay, you know, and birds, you all heard that. That comes out of some of these Gnostic Gospels, which everybody today seems to be raving about. At last we know the real Jesus from these Gospels that no one took any notice of at the time because they were short stories, interesting fantasies. Go back to the Gospels. That's where we've got all the truth of it. So Jesus as a little boy didn't make birds out of clay, I have to tell you. I wasn't there to, but just let's assume he didn't do that. He birds were birds. He loved them and he loved clay. And he might have made clay birds out of clay. Which reminds me of one of my early traumas. I've told you probably before, but I could have been Rodin, I reckon. I've got in me the capacity to be an artist of the first water. No. But as a little, what do you call this, kindergarten, oh no, we didn't have kindergarten, there was first class at school in here, a four-year-old, I came home with a plasticine of a cow. Now, Picasso couldn't have done as good a job. I'm serious. But my mother didn't understand that. And when I brought my cow home to show Mum, she just roared laughing. And I just couldn't ever do an artistic thing again. Oh, come on, cry a bit. Because my insensitive mother laughed. And the reason she laughed, and how can I remember it here 66 years later, whatever it is, because it was a cow, but the udder was enormous. And what my mother didn't realise is that when you're a little child and you look at a cow, that's the most significant thing you see. So, do you get me? It was a budding Picasso, nipped in the bud by a mother's irreverent laughter. Why did I tell you that? I don't know, now that I think about it.
Just being a little boy.
Oh, good on you. Jesus went down with them to Nazareth, was obedient to them. His mother treasured all these things in her heart, and Jesus increased in wisdom. Of course he did. He increased in stature. He had a sudden burst when he was about 13 or 14 or 15, or like me when he was 62. And he was in favour with God and with people. That's all we know. He mowed the lawns up the street for the lady up there, and we'd all little kids do, and that's all we know. He'll do. It's left to us to imagine the next 20 or 30 years, 20 or so years. How close must have been the communion between Jesus and his mother? Later, during Jesus' public ministry, a woman, we're told, in the crowd raised her voice and said to him, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breasts that suckled you." Indeed. So she probably thought, God, you must have had a great mother. And she was right. That's all we've got. On the third day. Wow. On the third day. Now, you might think on the third day, all right, could have been the second day, could have been the fourth. No, this happened on the third day. And you go back and read the book of Exodus, Hosea, Luke, Matthew. The third day is the day of revelation. The third day is the day, Exodus chapter 19, when God came down on Mount Sinai. The third day is the day when who God is revealed. You got it? It's not one, two, three, four. It's the third day, for God's sake. So it's on the third day. So as soon as you hear that, because you're not able to read the Gospels. We're not taught to read. Very few people could read and write in those days. Somebody has to get up and proclaim it. As soon as you hear on the third day, you think of Exodus, mountain, thunder and lightning, Moses. You with me? You got all the drama. There was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. This is John chapter 2, verse 1. We're at the beginning of the Gospel. We've just had the apostles gathering and the prologue, of course. This is right at the beginning. The first scene of the Gospel is this. There was a wedding in Cana of Galilee and the mother of Jesus was there. Now we know the rest of the story. The disciples are invited as well. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." You've got to stage it or you don't see it. This is the mother. She is the mother of Israel. She's every mother. She's like every man, you know, every woman. She's every woman that's ever longed for the Messiah. That's who she is on stage. She's representative of the whole of the people of God. And she's saying to the Messiah, "We've run out of wine." Wine is the symbol in the Bible of the Spirit. The joy, the dancing, the laughter, the love, the celebration of life as wine should be. And of the Spirit of God. Okay, so, and Jesus said to her, difficult woman, he calls her, in the drama. Now, what did Jesus call his mother? He probably said, called her Cuddles or something. I don't know what he called his mum. Or mum. What's wrong with that? Imma. But in the drama of the gospel, it's woman, because she's every woman. Do you get me? She's woman. She's not... She is who she is, but she's woman. That's more... She's Eve. Okay. What concern is that to you and me? And again, see, you can't read the Bible. I mean, people who just read it without... You've got to study. You've got to buy commentaries of someone who knows what they're talking about. I mean, seriously. You've got to... I've had to do all the work. You have to do the work too. You just can't grab the Bible and just quote it. And you wouldn't want to do that, would you? You can't do it with Shakespeare. You can with a lot of it. Everyone can talk about the parable of the prodigal son without too much study. But you can't expect to avoid having to look at a 2,000-year-old document with no knowledge of the society it was brought in. You just can't. It's silly to think you can do it, and you shouldn't do it. And if it's worth studying Shakespeare, it's worth studying the New Testament. And you've got to study it. Not as well as... Okay. So... What concern is that to you and me? That's a typical expression in the Bible, in the Old Testament. It occurs many times, and it has two possibilities it could mean. One means, got nothing to do with what you're doing, like back off. The other meaning is, what concern is it to you? Do you know what you're asking? Do you realise the significance of your question? It's a kind of a... Now, either you're refusing to do anything about it, or you're inviting the person to a deeper level of understanding. And there's texts that have both... that idiom for both. In this case, it's very obviously the second, because Jesus does something about it. Do you get me? He's not refusing his mother. So, what concern... Are you sure you know what you're asking for? Do you see what I see? Can you see this woman, meaning woman? Israel. Do you see what you're wanting? If you want wine, do you know what it means? Do you see what you're asking for? Are you sure you want it? Do you get it? People say they want to be free, okay? I'll try you. Do you want to be free? Do you really want to be free? Do you want to take the implications of being a free human being? Or is it a bit easier just to slip into the crowd and do what you're told and to switch it on and switch it off and go to bed? I mean, do you want to be free? Big question. This is terrible, the next bit. Because you'll find in your Bible, my hour has not yet come, won't you? That's what all the texts say. They may be right. There's no punctuation in the Greek Bible. If it's a question and not a statement, and this goes right back, I'm giving you an opinion that hasn't found its way into the commonly accepted understanding, but I'm quite sure this is right. Now, that's silly, but I am, dramatically. What Jesus actually said is, not my hour has not yet come, but has not my hour now come, is a perfect translation of the Greek, once you see it's a question. And it makes complete sense of the passage. How, don't you see that my hour has come? It's all right, Mother, don't worry. There's nothing to be worried about. My hour has come. He's ready now for the mission, and he starts. And the mission is the pouring out of wine, and not really. Jesus didn't go to a wedding banquet, for God's sake, and turn water into wine. I mean, well, did he or didn't he? I don't know, but that's not what the passage is telling you. He's talking about Jesus was always turning water into wine. He was always turning the human condition into something divine. He was always bringing people to a depth and a width and a height of knowledge and understanding. He was always inspiring people to the depths of the Spirit of... Do you get me? That's what it's about. And it's put first because the whole gospel in John is about this. About celebrating life. About I've come that you may live and live to the full. About a marriage banquet with God. About love. And that's what people needed to know, because everybody in the world pretty well, and might be that case pretty well still, is easily sucked into a dominating God, doing what you're told, doing what the imam tells you on God's behalf, being a soldier and going in and blasting Gaza because you're told to by your military, you know what I mean, blanket bombing Germany. My brother was part of that. Well, I'm sure he regrets it now, but what do you do when you're 20 and you're told what to do and that's what everybody's doing, you know what I mean? So now the catechism says that blanket bombing of cities is an atrocity against God. That's the Catholic teaching on the matter, and he's a beautiful Catholic boy doing it because he didn't know. And the church wasn't that clear about it then either. Do you get me? So there's all this stuff. All right. And the beautiful mother's question to him was, do whatever he tells you. Right on the knocker. Do what he tells you. Listen to the inspiration of grace. Do what the Messiah says and something beautiful will come, and the wine begins to flow. That's John. So we come straight to... You remember in the... This is not only there, it's in the Gospel of Mark too, when Jesus is not fasting, and they say, why aren't you? And he said, why would my disciples fast when the bridegroom is with them? Bridegroom, God, the lover of humanity. You are learning to think with your art part of your brain, aren't you, when you go to the Gospel? And there are people in this world who pin it all down, never beautifully, I have to tell you, pin it all down like the fundamentalism is an absolute virus, uncontrollable virus. And it's pumped out by, again, it's that country that went from barbarism to decadence without passing through civilization. It's similar in the religious setting. It's absurd stuff, dreadful stuff. If you did it to Shakespeare, you wouldn't get to first base. Do it with the Bible, everyone thinks you're faithful. No, read it with your heart too. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, says John the Baptist. The friend of the bridegroom stands and hears, is greatly rejoices when he hears the bridegroom's voice. So Jesus is the bridegroom, the lover. It's about love. So the only other scene where Jesus, Mary appears in John's Gospel is there. Standing near the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas and Mary Magdalene. Who were those four characters there? His mother's there in John's Gospel. His mother's sister is there, and if you read Matthew and Mark and Luke, that's Salome, probably the wife of Zebedee. His mother's sister, which makes James and John actually Jesus' first cousins, which is highly likely. Then there's the wife of Clopas, another Mary. Mary was such a common name, obviously. There's a few of them there. Early tradition, Hegesippus it was, in the beginning of the 2nd century, said, was he right? I don't know, but we've just got it. He said Clopas was Joseph's brother. So again, this is another auntie of Jesus. Only family were allowed at such a thing. The Romans were piety. Pietà was one of the great Roman virtues. And even when they're slaughtering people, they would allow the mother and the father and the aunties and uncles to be there. You know, and say what you like about that. But at least they were superstitious people, but pietà was the family virtue that they would not... And so you're allowed to bury your own dead and, you know, all that. It was barbaric, but there were limits to the barbarism. And so they're all there, and Mary of Magdalene's there. How the hell did she get in? You've known Mary Magdalene's in your life, and you can't keep them away. It would have taken the whole Roman army to keep this girl away. So she wasn't an auntie, she wasn't a cousin, she wasn't a part of the family, but she'd have scratched your eyes out, and probably they thought, oh, God, let her in, you know. There's some people who get their own way because they're so passionate, aren't they? And be that, good on you, go for it. So anyhow, there's the group there. And when Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing beside her, he said to his mother, woman, here is your son. And he said to the disciple, here is your mother. And that little scene, why did he say to John, the beloved disciple, here is your mother? If John was his first cousin, that's exactly what he'd do. He's entrusting his mother. In those days, a woman without a male to earn money and protect, because they had no financial capacity in the public arena. They were widows, real widows. They were just staff. I mean, to summon it. So he's asking his first cousin, John, because John's mother's there. He's saying, look, would you look after Mum? Keep it simple. And John says, of course I'll do it. And then Jesus feels a bit happier that that's happening. Why wouldn't you? But it's become a beautiful symbol here. For Mary, the mother of the church. But actually in the passage of John, the primary focus is Mary's being looked after by the beloved disciple, not the beloved disciples being looked after by Mary, you know? I'm not putting them as against each other, but the primary focus of John's thing is John, the beloved disciple, lover, is going to care for the mother. It's beautiful and simple and makes sense. And it's rightly been seen as mutual, of course. And now we have that whole image of Mary being the mother. In the scene at Cana, she's the mother, the woman, called woman again here, by the way, Eve. She's the woman who represents all of Israel. Now, at the end of Jesus' life, when the hour has really come, it begins in Cana. My hour has now come, but the hour has only come in its initial... There's a bit of water coming over the dam, but the whole thing happens when they pierce his heart on the cross and the water and blood come forth. That's the fullness of the hour. And the woman is there again with him. Highly significant passages where Mary is there. I've got an article here. I only got it a couple of days ago. It was given to me. The Little Company of Mary, a beautiful religious order, as you know, care for the sick. God knows why they don't get vocations. If you've got a girl, a daughter anywhere, husbands are fair enough. I mean, you know, a bloke in your life's all right. But if you could get them to join the Little Company of Mary, they'd have such a beautiful life. Care, and the aged need care now more than ever, don't they? Mm-hmm. So it's a mystery to me why. Anyhow, they won't get a better life than with these women. They won't mind that little advertisement. But this is Dadiri, their little magazine. And it's an article by Mary, Mother of the Church, written by Elizabeth West, whom you may know. She's an LCM sister. She's Morris West's daughter, the great Morris West. So it's a lovely article. I've promised it to someone to take away now for the holiday. But if I can find out how to get I've asked them on the web to give me a way of getting it electronically. Mary, Mother of the Church. It's lovely, and it's picking up John Paul II, who did have, as we said, a lovely devotion to Mary, a very Polish one, but a lovely one. And he was very strong on the Marian dimension of the Church. He was strong in theory about it. You might question how he was in practice, but you could do the same for me and probably all of us. Our practice and theory don't always hold together. But he was the Petrine. He puts the Petrine, which is the authoritative male, if you like, hierarchical order. But he says correctly, as the Catechism does, and we did this with you earlier, the Marian dimension is more important, more central, because the Marian is the mother, the nurturer, the lover, you know, the kind of whatever that symbolic thing of woman and man means to us. And I know it's varied and complex, but the Marian, so that all ministry has to be a mothering before it's a fathering, if you know what I mean, before, after, you know, they're not good words, are they? But closer to the heart of the Church is the service, caring, motherly compassion, and the canon law sounds a bit like the male thing, and we need it, just as you need a mum and dad and a home and all that, and you're whoever, all that, don't need more than that. But it's good to hear the Church saying that the Marian dimension is more central, or it has to be pervasive all the time, lest the Petrine, authoritarian, hierarchic, male canon law structure dominate. And it's very hard for that not to dominate, because it's so clear and organised, and there's a lot of energy put into it, isn't there? We've got to put a lot more energy into the mothering Church. Well, that's what they're saying. Pope John Paul II said it a lot, and then people who are close to him, and the way he actually organised the Church, maybe as a person he was like that, but the public image was often pretty strong, and we don't know. God only can judge all these things. So there's the end. That's Michelangelo. It's the only statue Michelangelo ever put his name on. He was only 18, I think, and nobody believed that he could do it. That you can't see it there, the Pietà. Nobody could believe. So he came in and he hammered on this cross piece across the breast there. Michelangelo Buonarroti a face questo, or something, I don't know the exact words, but I did this. Came in at night and chiselled it on. They had to believe him. So there's that. They took the body of Jesus, wrapped it in spices, and since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. And that's been a haunting and very beautiful image for the Church, for the beautiful mother of Jesus. Here's the next New Testament. That's a little window in some church of Pentecost. Another scene of Mary from the New Testament, because it's our only source, as was pointed out earlier. In the upstairs room where they were staying, the 12 were constantly, this is Acts chapter 1, the 12 were constantly devoting themselves to prayer. That's the 11 plus Matthias now, who's been brought in to replace Judas. together with certain women, including Mary, the mother of Jesus, as well as his brothers. Brothers can mean, as it does in many simple cultures, it can mean your sibling, but it can also mean your cousin or your half-brother or your step-brother or, you know, any male in the extended family. So the tradition has been that Jesus was the only son and that these were actually his cousins, which is highly likely. That's the only tradition that's ever been around, so why not? Could be right too. It's not a big issue, but there it is. But it is related to how you understand the virginity of Mary too. There's a link in there. All right, so Mary's there, and so that's been a symbol too. She's the one who kind of held the church together. Probably exactly what she did, and some great women do that, don't they? Held the family together. So no wonder they kind of loved her and admired her and quickly saw her as the perfect disciple, or the one that was the model for them of how to really listen, how to do God's will. And here's Acts chapter 2, when the day of Pentecost had come, they were all together when suddenly from heaven there came a sound like a rush of a violent wind, and it filled the entire house where they were sitting. Divided tongues as a fire appeared among them, and a tongue rested on each of them, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit. Had you been there that day with a video, like most videos, you may have seen nothing. You might have picked up the talk and the clutter. But something happened on that day, clearly. They'd gone out, they'd fled at Pentecost, Passover, and 50 days later, that's 7 sevens of 49 plus one, so that's why it was 50 days later. At the end of the harvest, there was another big feast called Pentecost, which means the 50th day. So the Jews came back, and as they came back to Jerusalem for the next big celebration of the Jewish people, among them were these people probably scared and a bit tentative and trying not to talk too much, so no one recognised the Galileans were Peter and Andrew and James and John all coming back from their various things back to Jerusalem, meeting again, and they went up into the upper room and they locked themselves in again, you know, because they're still scared of what are we going to do? You know, we've got this mission, but how do we do it? And they're there, and then something wonderful happened in that community that day, which enabled them to open the doors and just go out and give it for all their worth, and the church was born in one image, Luke's image. From John's Gospel, the church is born from the pierced heart of Jesus on the cross. So it's not a time thing. Luke dramatizes it powerfully here. So whatever happened, each one had their gift and their strength and their love, and their lives proved it. They lived heroic. And it's the mother of Jesus who was there with them. So now we come to the last. Mary, we're told by Pius XII in 1950... was taken up body and soul into heavenly glory. Anything said about Mary is about Mary, but it means it's always about us. It's always saying she's the model. So if this happened to her, it'll happen to me, you. This is what we're asked to believe. We're watching someone who, there's no complexity about Mary. She's not the incarnation of God. She's simply a woman, you know what I mean? As Jesus is simply a man too. But we haven't got the same connotations here. So we're talking about someone who was redeemed, clearly, who was loved, who was a human being, period, and so on. So what's said about her is said about me and you too, all of us. So that's what this is all about. And I'm giving you the historical setting as best I can. In 1950, after the carnage of the Second World War, in which brackets Christian Europe for the second time in a few years had been tearing itself to pieces, and you remember that, Pope Pius XII felt the need to stress that Christian life is very much about the body. We can't pray in the spirit and then treat the body with such disregard. It's every part of us that's taken into life. Transformed, of course, in a way that's beyond our imagining. But everything that makes us human is sacred. And that's what this is saying. The whole of who Mary is transformed and taken into the mystery of God. The declaration of Mary's assumption is not meant to separate us from us. On the contrary, it was to remind us that that's our destiny too. As with purgatory, so with heaven, we have to eliminate the idea of time, for time is the measure of all things in the world that we know. It's not a measure of eternity. We've got this little funny saying that we keep using, but keep remembering. Oh, you check, think about it. We actually don't know what we're talking about. We say, oh, at the end of time. You could have the image, people do have the image, I used to have it, I haven't got it now, of like every, people who die, and we're all kind of cemeteries and there's all this thing, and there's people who are cremated and that's a bit of a problem, and so we're all here, and at the end of time there's going to be this great rattle, and there all these femurs and tibias and things are all going to come sorting themselves out, and then we'll all work out who's what, and you're going to say, no, that's mine. I go, no, that's mine, and it's mine, and it's gone through so many processes. I'm not actually trying to make fun of it, I'm just trying to make fun of our images that we're waiting till the end of time. So did you hear Joe Rheinberger died?
Yes.
Amazing, isn't it? He died on Saturday. He was 70 today. He would have been 70 today. And he died in his sleep on Saturday night after having said Mass. Well, Joe died. Does that mean... I mean, we bury the body, and the body will... You can still see the bones and all that later. What's that got to do with the risen body? I haven't got the foggiest idea. Probably nothing. But the what's wrong with... what happened to Mary happening to all of us? Why aren't we taken into the mystery of God in a... Or have you got this image which I used to have of Mary and Jesus kind of up in heaven? I don't know, they're playing draughts or something. But they're the only two there, really. And everyone else is kind of going... floating around, waiting for the end of the time till the body is resurrected. So what we do, instead of doing theology, we let the images that we almost inevitably have to think about as though the images are true, rather than get to the truth of what we're saying and realise that our images are only our images. So forget time once death comes. It's a nothing. It's a non-issue. It's nothing to do with time. We're in time, yes. But from God's point of view, it's all nothing. It's all moment. It's all now. Everything's now. So now Mary is with God. We believe that. We know it. It's said about her. Having been said about her, the implications, surely, are that this is true for all of us. Has to be that. As with purgatory, we have to eliminate the idea of time, for time is the measure of things in the world we know. It's not a measure of eternity. Awaiting the end of time is part of the hard wiring of our brains, unable to imagine anything outside the categories of space and time. Beyond death, the notion of time is meaningless. Our prayer and our hope is that Jesus will come to us at our death. We had it in the Gospel on Sunday. And he'll take you by the hand and say, Talita kum, presuming he still speaks Aramaic. By now he would probably have learnt Gaelic. And he'd speak Irish. What other language would heaven have other than the Irish? St. Patrick. Seriously, it would have to be Irish. But anyhow... if he hasn't yet learnt that and he's still talking Aramaic, he'd say, Talita cum. Rise up. And he doesn't bring us back into this life. He takes us into the eternal life, which is the goal of our existence. Our prayer and our hope is that Jesus will come to us at our death as he came to his mother and draw us with the whole of our human reality transformed fully by love into God's eternal embrace. Finally, this is the last page. The Catechism reminds us that Mary's mediation, and the same can be said of the mediation with all the communion of saints, is not independent of the mediation of Jesus. Nothing. And that's something that some people in the Protestant Church have just... they don't, probably because of the way we do things, they don't understand them, and that could be our fault. I'm not blaming anybody here. But they think we worship Mary, or they... think, why have Mary mediating? There's only one mediator, Jesus. Of course there's only one mediator, Jesus. But Jesus mediates his love. Well, I hope today he might be doing it to you through me. What's the problem? I live no longer, I but Christ. You know what I mean? Wherever any of us respond to grace, it's the mediation of Jesus, but it comes to us through our own mother, who teaches us that her... Jesus isn't teaching me directly, he's teaching me through my mother and my father and my uncle and the teachers and the Marish brothers I went to and you, and you know. So mediation is everywhere. Everything's mediating grace. So that Mary be a mediatrix, be the one who's mediating grace to us, of course. Therese of Lisieux, your mother or grandmother who's died and was a saint, is mediating grace to you. But it's not independent of... it's not Jesus or Mary. It's not Jesus forgiving you or the priest forgiving you. The priest doesn't actually forgive you any. He says, I absolve you. Well, I is Jesus, isn't it? This is my body. It's not his. It's the... So these are the mediation of grace. Thank God. It's a very Catholic idea. Very orthodox idea, very Anglican idea, but it's absolutely simple that everything mediates love and mediates grace, and it's all, I am the vine, you are the branches. We're not independent vines, so we're not arguing. It's just that Jesus' love is so all-encompassing that it flows through everyone to us, and he wouldn't want it any other way, surely. He's the only mediator, as Paul tells us in Timothy. The only mediator. So you don't have two mediators independent, but you have that mediator mediating through everyone, and especially in a way through his mother. It's Jesus' life that we share. It's Jesus' spirit that gives us life. It's Jesus' priesthood, Jesus' prayer, Jesus' mediation that he offers us, for we are his body. Paul could say, it's no longer I who live, it's Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God. Most translations put, by faith in the Son of God. That's not necessarily a wrong translation, but it's a genitive in Greek, and the simplest translation, and the one to which scholars are more and more thinking, this is what it means, that we're living by the faith of the Son of God. It's by Jesus' faith that we share. He gives us his faith, his openness to grace, his welcoming of love, and giving himself for me. How much truer this is. If that's true of Paul, and increasingly true of us, how much truer is it of Mary?